This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
So, welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour, second part of the show, which we call the Big Picture, in which we try to put some sense into all of the data points that are rolling around out there that you're hearing about. You know, right now, at least judging from some of the reports, for the United States, things are looking good. The stock market keeps hitting records. The U.S. economy has picked up in the second quarter, growing at an annualized rate of about 2.6%. Unemployment is the lowest in decades, and wages are actually rising. In energy, oil prices are stable, and gasoline is low, which is really good in the summer season because people like to travel, and that keeps the cost of that down. Inflation is actually falling, but when you look at it, the U.S. economy and the stock market are in their ninth year of recovery. And some questions are starting to surface. Are we actually in the ninth inning, even though the crowd feels pretty good right now? So then the bottom line question is, how long can the good times last, and what will be the incident or circumstance that will end it all?
Well, I suspect, John, given history, what will end this is what ends every bull market and leads us into recession. It'll be a Fed rate raising cycle. I mean, these guys pretty much crash the airplane about 95% of the time. The only time I can remember, at least in my investment career, that that didn't happen was in 1994. But pretty much, if you look at every bear market, every recession, go back to 2007, when the economy went into recession, the bear market or the stock market peaked, what preceded it? A Fed rate raising cycle. Go back to 2001, what preceded it? A Fed rate raising cycle. Go back to 91, Fed rate raising cycle. Go back to 81, Fed rate raising cycle, as well as several of the ones that occurred in the 70s, the 60s, and the 50s. So they are moving. However, there's one thing I do pick up this time. They are moving cautiously this time as they did. Actually, when you think about it, they did that last time in 2004 when they started raising rates rather than big half a point, 1 point increases as Greenspan did in the 90s. He only did it a quarter point at a time. But they wanted to get back to that 5%. That was their goal. And they didn't read the tea leaves. We've played the clip here in 2007 when Bernanke took over for Greenspan and they asked him about real estate. And he said, real estate's doing really great, even though it had peaked already. So the Fed never sees it. They're always looking through the rearview mirror. So eventually, as always, they're going to overdo it. It's not like monetary science is some exact science where you can precisely gauge human behavior or events. And so how will it end, John? I suspect it's going to end as it always does. Eventually, it'll be a rate hike too far. And now, even though they're only expecting maybe one more hike this year, maybe December, but they're going to start shrinking the balance sheet. Now, what does that do? As we've talked on the show, eventually they are going to be rolling over or stopping the reinvestment of $30 billion a month within the next three quarters. And so eventually that is money that's coming out of the market. That is a withdrawal of liquidity. You add that to rate hikes and eventually somewhere down the road, unless policy changes and we start to weaken and they hold off. But right now they're hell bent on raising interest rates and they'll keep doing it until something happens. That's generally the way this ends.
So at this stage of the game, if we go up high, you know, let's go up to the 40,000 foot level and look back down on the whole terrain, how do things actually look?
I mean, right now, the economy and the stock market, you know, there's several things going for it, both short and long-term tailwinds that could probably extend this rally and this economic recovery into next year. And there's nothing on the horizon that we can see right now. And we're going to get into the weeds here. We're going to talk about catalysts. We're going to talk about the LEIs and just the way they look right now. And quite honestly, there's nothing out there that would be a risk or a danger to the market, unforeseen, some kind of black swan, some kind of major event. I mean, outside of Pearl Harbor, what could go wrong? Well, there's more things that are positive in terms of tailwinds for the economy and the market than there are negatives. Now, let's talk about a couple of these. In the near term, we have some catalysts. If you take a look at all the surveys out there, you have rising business confidence. You have rising consumer confidence, although that is not yet translated into higher retail sales. You do have increased bank lending, but there are a couple of red flags. We'll get into those later. And you have small business optimism, and that's important because almost 90% of all new jobs are created by new businesses and startups. Hard to believe. In the last decade, you had companies like Facebook, you had Twitter, you had Google, and some of those companies that started out of nowhere. Look how big they are today. Big, giant tech behemoths. And think of the influence they had, not only in job creation, but on the economy itself. So those are the near-term catalyst. So right now, at least over the next couple months, that would be positive.
Okay, those are short-term. So what about long-term, something that might make this sustainable all the way into next year?
Well, I suppose the best thing you have going for it right now are rising corporate profits. I mean, corporate profits are expected to be up double digits for second quarter, at least companies reporting. There's been a few misses. And also, that's on top of double-digit rising corporate profits. And more importantly, what we're starting to see this time is there has been a lot of financial engineering, but we're starting to see increases on the top line, which is revenue growth, which is always good because a lot of what we've seen over the last 6 or 7 years has been financial engineering. Companies buying back stock, companies going into the debt market, restructuring their debt at lower interest rates, or going into the debt market, leveraging up their balance sheet to either increase dividends or buy back stocks. Rising corporate profits is leading to an increase in capital spending. Now, a lot of that, albeit, is coming from the energy sector, especially with drill rigs this year doubling over where they were last year. We've got rising productivity, and we've had a slight uptick in money velocity. So those are some of the long-term and near-term catalyst, and those are the things that at least remain positive now, and that's why we've seen economic growth pick up in the second quarter, although it was a little bit less than some people were expecting and typically lower than what we've seen over the last 5 or 6 years.
We've seen this pattern over the last few years when the economy will pick up, but then it slows down in usually the fourth quarter of the year, maybe first quarter, and then it picks up again in second and third quarter. So if we look at longer term things or like the LEIs, what are they saying?
Well, I mean, if we take a look at, let's start with the big ones. Second quarter GDP came in at, let's round it off, 2.6%. That was up from 1.2%, so it more than doubled. And this has been the pattern we've seen throughout this economic recovery. The strongest quarters of the year tend to be Q2 and Q3. So there was nothing that was on the sales calls, the analyst calls that we've been monitoring where companies are saying, hey, we had a great quarter, but it's third quarter's looking a little iffy. We're going to downgrade our earnings. In fact, what has helped the stock market is not only companies reporting that their second quarter profits beat estimates and came in pretty strong, but some companies were actually raising their estimates for the rest of the year. And you always want that because we've seen more analyst upgrades versus, let's say, analyst downgrades. So that was good. Now let's take a look at some of the biggies. The ISM Manufacturing Index ticked down a bit from 57.8 down to 56.3, but still well in positive territory above 50. That is looking pretty good. Now, the ISM non-manufacturing index slipped from 57.4 down to 53.9. That's something we're going to keep an eye on because that is something, the service economy is bigger than the manufacturing economy, and we're going to be watching that to make sure that this doesn't slow down, because if the service economy starts slowing down, you always look for divergences. We saw that a little bit earlier in the year where the service side was doing better than the, let's say, manufacturing side. So these two reports bear watching, but right now, John, they're still looking pretty good. And what's more important, and this tells you a little bit about where it's going to go in the future, is backlogs. That means orders that haven't been filled plus new orders are still looking very strong in both the ISM indexes. Also, we're starting to see other corroborating indicators support that. Industrial production is ticking up, so that supports the ISM manufacturing numbers. Factory orders jumped sharply in the month of June and have been positive since December. So you always like to see, when you see a major indicator, you always like to see supporting indicators supporting it with it as well. It's kind of like the technicians on the show, when they ever take a look at the stock markets hitting new record levels, they always like to see breadth, meaning that there are other stocks that are rising as well. It's not just the big blue chips. Durable good orders were also up. They jumped, but this indicator has been all over the map all year, so I'm not putting much credence with that. But if you also look at some of the what we call the regional Fed surveys, and I want to start out with the main one. This is one that we follow rather closely, and that's the Philly Fed Index. It looks at the major economies of every state in the country. And right now, every state in the country is looking pretty good. There's nothing that looks recessionary, and that's something you want to monitor closely, because if you see, let's say, key areas like Texas, New York, Massachusetts, or California start to weaken, some of the major production areas of the state start to weaken, then that tells you you may have some problems. Business conditions, they're up 12 months in a row, but some red flags here in this. New orders drop from 25.9 down to 2.1, and there is a gap between new orders and inventories. New orders are still up. Inventories, that gap has narrowed. So you always want to see a wide gap between inventories and new orders, because that means the manufacturers have to make more stuff because there's not enough inventories around to support the sales coming in. Then inventory production dries up GDP. So that's something we're looking at. And the labor market is positive, but it also weakens. So nothing, I guess a few red flags there, but overall that is looking strong.
Well, okay, if we look at the indicators here, LEIs are looking good, economy is picking up, and corporate earnings are moving up. Anything else?
Well, I mean, the thing that we're looking at, the forward-looking indicators moved up in the Philly Fed. So despite some of the things that we talked about are softening in the current conditions, the forward-looking indicators are saying this is temporary, it should pick up. So even though there are some red flags, it basically, the forward indicators are something we pay a little bit more attention to, because if the forward indicators were kind of rolling over, then we'd say that we give a lot more credence to what these red flags are telling us. So if there is a recession, it certainly isn't showing up when you look at the economic conditions of the states. Even in the oil patch states, they're looking pretty good at this point in states like Texas, North Dakota, Oklahoma. But also, you know, if we take a look at, it's not just the LEIs. If you take a look at some of the regional Fed surveys, Chicago Index Fed survey is improving. It's a mixed picture, and it's been that way. Kansas City is down. That survey is down, but it's still positive. ISM New York spiked up. The Empire State Index, which is the larger index for New York, is down, but it remains in positive territory. And the Texas survey ticked up. Now, that was a weak one, as you can imagine, because that's where most of the big shale plays like the Permian Basin are in. In 2017, the big story in Texas has been the pickup in drilling activity that we're seeing in shale. So overall, things are looking pretty good, whether you're looking at the LEIs, whether you're looking at the forward indicators, you're looking at the Fed survey, the ISM, the regional, everything is looking good at this point.
So if the LEIs are positive, and currently we don't have any, at least near-term signs of a recession, would you say we're going to be in clear sailing until sometime next year?
I would say so. I mean, you know, it's hard to say, because the fourth quarter and the first quarter of the year in this cycle have always been tricky quarters. It's going to be interesting when the Fed starts to shrink its balance sheet, which could begin as soon as October. What happens if they shrink their balance sheet 3 months in a row and then go with another rate hike in December, if we start to see some softening in all these LEIs? But right now, the U.S. Official recession indicator is dropped from 11 to 9. However, our own proprietary indicator for recession, the key level for us is 20, as it is for the national recession indicator, it ticked up from 9 to 12.5. So we like to look at ours more so because it's a lot more forward looking. But right now, even at 12.5, there's certainly no danger. And the only weakness we see, if anything, is in auto sales, which we believe peaked in 2016.
We've talked a lot about on the program here and also during the weekday show FS Insider that the things that seem to be big areas of support for this recovery have been robust auto sales and housing, which seems to be robust again.
Well, I mean, if you take a look at Q2 earnings showed the problems that you're starting to see in the softness in the auto market. All the big three missed their sales, many of them by double digits. And the other thing is it could be the peak for the auto industry itself. You're seeing some trends once again being driven by technology. The new thing is called ride sharing. And in the future, just as you call an Uber, you may be calling a driverless car. And there's another thing that's coming, just like we've seen Airbnb. John, they're starting to do the same thing in automobile sales. So you buy a car, and let's say you want to help defray some of the payments. There is an agency or a group. Sometimes the dealership may do this for you or the auto dealer, and you actually loan out your car like almost like an Uber. And so somebody wants to rent your car for a couple days to take a trip or even rent it for an afternoon. You start renting out your car just like some people are renting out their homes. And in the future, your drivers may no longer be drivers. So you may be flagging down an Uber, but there's nobody in the car. It'll be a driverless car. In fact, they're saying the trend over the next 10 years are you may not even own a car. The old model that you used to see, mom and dad both go to work. So mom and dad both have separate cars, and then you get a car for junior. So you have three cars in the family. You look at most homes, two or three car garages. In the future, that may not happen. You may be going in a driverless car, and you may actually rent a car, just like, for example, people that live in New York City. I had, it was funny, and this was early on in my career, I had a client spent his entire life in New York City, and when he came out, one of the first things that we had to do is shop for and get a car, because when he lived in Manhattan, and basically any place he went, he either walked or he took a car. Well, that is in our future.
So if we're looking at indicators, audio industry has peaked, and that probably leaves us just with the consumer and housing right now.
Well, the trend in retail sales is weakening, which has been somewhat surprising given that we've seen strong consumer optimism numbers. Retail sales have been down the last 2 months, but a lot of that had to do with gasoline sales. Obviously, when the price of gasoline falls, as oil did when we got down into bear market territory in the low 40s, you're paying less at the gas pump. Well, that gets recorded in retail sales. But if you back out gasoline sales, they were still negative by 0.1%. So now, on the housing side, you get a little bit of a mixed picture, but overall, it is still positive. Housing, it's a seller's market in many areas of the country. You take a look at the NAHB index. It's been falling since March. Existing home sales are also falling. They've been falling along with NAHB index since March. Now, that's on the negative side. On the positive side, new construction, which is positive, and pending home sales are up. But if you take all of these, add them together, present and future sales, John, remain quite favorable for housing because there's a number of things. You have strong demand. You have very low inventories. I think I'd be more concerned about housing if you were seeing an inventory buildup. Inventories are down. The amount of months that homes are on the market. We had one individual in our office put their condominium on the market here in California, Southern California. John, any idea how quickly it sold?
Probably within a couple of hours of having that happen.
Absolutely. They put it on the market. The minute it was listed, it sold. First person walked through within 5 hours. The house was sold at full price. So low inventories, strong demand, favorable mortgage rates.
So if we assume that the LEIs are going to remain positive, what can go wrong with what we call, I guess, a Goldilocks picture right now? If we were looking out, you know, I'm always what-ifing in a lot of areas. What are the black swans or landmines that could suddenly spring out and tank this other than Fed policy?
Well, let's talk about number one, in terms of landmines, is Washington dysfunction. I mean, there are a lot of things that this market has been rising on with expectations certain things were going to get done. At the top of the list was healthcare, and we saw that that failed, although they're still saying they plan on resurrecting it. We just had, on the day we're doing this, Mueller has just started a grand jury, or asked for a grand jury investigation to Russia, so that's expanding, and the media is going haywire with this, you know, basically making this look like it's Watergate, which it isn't. Also, the next thing on the agenda is tax cuts. If they can't get health care and they cannot get tax cuts, that would be a disappointment. Right now, the Democrats are opposed to tax cuts for the upper income individuals that pay the majority of taxes. And it could end up, John, that even with the Republicans controlling the White House, both houses of the legislature, you end up with the do-nothing Congress. And you got to remember, when the Trump rally began, we're up, what, with almost over 20% since going back to November 8th, it was based on the fact that they were going to repeal Obamacare. And there was an interesting story. The picture on Obamacare keeps getting worse and worse. Obamacare premiums nationwide are up 25% this year. And it was interesting because McCain was one of the senators that voted against it. And yet Arizona's Obamacare premiums are up 116%. The Wall Street Journal just did a story this week, and there's 10 states where the insurers are asking for a 30% medical premiums for 2018. So what happens if they don't do health care because Obamacare is imploding in cost or skyrocketing? Tax cuts. If they don't do tax cuts, there's a big thing that a lot of corporate, if you take a look at small business optimism, corporate optimism, even investor optimism, a lot of it is based on the fact that, you know, if you put in corporate tax reform, you bring the tax rates down from 35% down to 20 or down to 15, wherever they end up. I think it's, if they do it, it's probably going to be closer to 20. But think what that does to the bottom line. If you make $100 of profit, instead of paying $35 in taxes, you pay 20. Well, that's $15 more that goes to the bottom line. And then the other thing is infrastructure spending. Although this is something I don't think is going to have an immediate impact. I don't think this is as big a deal as health care and tax cuts, because even if they were to vote on infrastructure, as we saw with even Obama's stimulus, it took 2 to 3 years to get implemented. And then finally, deregulation. About the only thing that has been done at this point has been deregulation, and that's been done with presidential executive powers.
Well, now what about oil prices? Because remember when they first plummeted down through 100, they called it a stimulus, but by the time it got down to 20, then they were really looking at it differently because it was impacting the economy.
Falling oil prices would not be good. If you take a look at investment, pickup in investment, especially on the corporate side this year, a lot of that came from the oil sector with the rig count that a lot of these oil companies, especially in the shale country, were investing in the oil sector. And of course, that could mean more layoffs because a lot of people have been added back. Remember, the oil industry shed well over 100,000 jobs, and these were high-paying jobs. But there's been a number of stories, story after story, with the major companies. I don't care if you're looking at Exxon, Chevron, Royal Dutch, Total, they're all saying they're learning to live and make money in an environment of $40 to $50 oil. I can remember when shale first came on the scene, the break-even point used to be $70 to $80, then it came down to $60. That's what OPEC thought would be the case when they pumped all out and thought they were going to put shale producers out of business. Instead, the industry adapted, and now you even have companies that can make money on shale in the $30 range. So that would be a negative. Number three, and this would be a rising dollar and rising interest rates, because right now what we've seen, the dollar has dropped, the index has dropped from 102 down to about 91. A lot of that has to do with the pickup and economic growth overseas. Interest rates have gone down, and that also has to do with the spread between what interest rates here in the U.S. are compared to what they are in Europe and Japan and elsewhere. But a rising dollar and rising interest rates, that could be a negative for the economy. In addition to that, credit growth. Right now, it is positive, but it is slowing down, and we are now starting to see, this could be a possible red flag, is banks are reporting an increase in credit card delinquency. And why that's important is if you take a look at rising consumer optimism, the lowest unemployment rate in decades, rising wages, and at the same time, you've got rising delinquencies on credit cards. A lot of this spending that has been fueling this economy over the last couple of years is brought about by an increase in credit card debt. Now you're starting to see delinquencies, especially in the auto sector. And so that's something to keep your eye on. And then I guess let's throw out the big proverbial one that we talk about each year, and that is a slowdown in China. And everybody remembers the big scare in 2015. In August and September 2015, 2018, where the stock market dropped nearly 10% in each month as a result of a possible slowdown of the world's second largest economy. So there are a number of issues out there, John, but here's the important thing about black swans or rogue waves. When you have an economy that is growing, it acts as a better shock absorber to handle these black swans or rogue waves. But at the moment, John, everything we have is looking good. I don't care if it's LAIs, surveys, corporate profits, everything is in link, as you would expect to see in the final cycle of an economy that is probably closer to recession than it is away from it, as we are now in the ninth year. The longest recovery that we've seen was the recoveries we saw in the 80s and 90s, when we went a full decade before we had a recession. And of course, Fed rate hikes brought an end to both of those recoveries.
Let's flip this over. I mean, you were just talking here about wild cards, but now let's try the opposite approach here and say, what are things that could extend this recovery? You know, well, let the question lie there as it is.
Well, let's get back to Washington. Most of these catalysts are going to be Washington driven. Tax cuts would be top of the list, because when you cut taxes, what does that do? It puts money in people's pockets. So that's money they can spend immediately versus, let's say, infrastructure. If you cut corporate taxes, what does that do? It increases corporate earnings, which could drive higher stock prices, which could drive corporate investment. So at the top of the list, number one would be tax cuts. This could be the big one if Republicans can pull this off, especially if they go after overseas profits, because you have about $2.6 trillion of untaxed profits that remain overseas. There is talk about a tax holiday where they would give these companies, let's say, a special tax rate. Even if they lower taxes to 20, they might say, hey, if you bring those profits home, we will tax them at 10%. And so not only would that be a big windfall, that could be $100 to $200 billion windfall for the government to help pay for some of these tax cuts. So number one catalyst would be tax cuts. Number two, and this is a big one, a steeper yield curve. Now, you might think of, if interest rates were to rise on long-term interest rates, that might initially be negative, but that would encourage banks to lend more, because the profit margin between what they pay you, the depositor, and then what they turn around and charge you to borrow money for a car, home, or whatever it is, or even a business, that would help expand GDP. So this could be a killer combination for GDP if you were to combine tax cuts with a steeper yield curve, which would spur credit growth in the economy. And, you know, the thing that I keep looking at this politically, John, you follow Washington closer than I do, but what are Republicans going to tell voters in November of next year if they couldn't repeal Obamacare, they couldn't deliver on taxes, and they couldn't do anything on infrastructure? I would say that would be a very, very negative scenario. You could very well see that if they couldn't get this, they could take a shellacking in the polls and be voted out of power.
Yeah, and it's going to be interesting, because I think that could be another revolution at the polls in the primaries, not in the actual elections, but in the primaries, because there is this war going on inside the Republican Party right now. And the people that did the whole change in the last elections are waiting to see all the promises fulfilled. So far, it hasn't been very good from their point of view. And so this could mean another overthrow.
Well, let's talk about another third catalyst. Once again, this is coming from Washington and the White House. That's regulatory reform. They're talking about repealing some of the more restrictive measures on Dodd-Frank. And we've already seen the president do that with executive order. So he's delivering on that. Number four is infrastructure. And there seems to be agreement between both parties to do this, because nothing a congressman loves to do then come home to his district and say, look at the projects and the jobs I created by going to Washington representing my district. The only problem for the economy, it takes 2 to 3 years to work its way and have any impact. So would that do much for GDP? Psychologically, it might. It might help certain stocks, but I doubt very seriously if it would have any meaningful impact in the short term on the economy.
So if we sum all of this up for this part of the program, the LERs are looking positive. I mean, we do have short-term tailwinds out there, possible big catalysts, which could actually extend the recovery. Tax cuts would be one of them. There are some other things that would do that. Very few signs of what we would call landmines or black swans out there and instability. So for now, I'd say everything's looking all right, but you may still want to keep your eye on the exit, I'm assuming, because you never know when those winds are going to change. But for now, it's okay.
Yeah, it's okay right now. And it's safe to say, however, what really happens, I think, in the fourth quarter, a lot of this, once again, and going forward for the market and economy as we end the year and go into next year, really, John, is going to be determined by Washington. What the Federal Reserve does, will they hike rates in December as expected? What will be the impact as they begin to shrink their balance sheet? And will the Republicans get together and unify and actually get something done? And the most important thing that there seems to be more agreement within the party is doing some kind of tax reform. There may be compromises. So what happens, I guess, going forward, it's hard to say, but a lot of it really is going to depend on what happens in Washington, both with the legislation and also what the Fed does.
So specifically, as we always do here on the show, then let's bring it down to an investment standpoint. How do you play the market? What are you doing for your clients?
Well, you know, depending on accounts, we are between 70 and 80% in stocks, depending on client objectives. So to use the old cliche, we're still dancing because our recession indicator, even though it's risen, it's only at 12.5. So it's nowhere near 20. The LAIs are all positive. We have short-term, long-term tailwinds, and especially on the corporate profit front. And if you throw in a tax cut on that, this market is going much higher. And as our technicians have talked about here, I mean, this is a strong, strong push that we're seeing in the market. Breadth is positive, as the technicians will tell you, and you have a strong move. And this is usually what you see in the final phase of the bull market. In that third final wave, you see the public, and that's the good thing that we're starting to see in terms of the public is coming in now after being out of this market. They're finally jumping in. They're going into index funds, which will drive this market higher, will drive a lot of the FANG stocks higher. You always want to see the public come in towards the end because that's usually the sign you're in the final phase. That's happening right now. So for the moment, John, we're still dancing. We're still invested in the market, although, you know, like I said, we are not 100% invested. And as our LAIs and our recession indicator, if they would continue to climb, we would reduce that exposure. But we're doing things like we're more international because we think that's where the value is. So we have a considerable amount invested overseas right now. On bonds, we're using barbell strategies. We're using interest rate floaters because every time the Fed increases interest rates, which I think they'll continue to do, that means the interest on the bonds we own will be going up. So our clients will be getting more income. And it's kind of nice to get 4 or 5% yield in this kind of a market. So that's the way we're playing it right now. And I can't see anything that's going to change that in the short term because we have quite a few things that we follow. Not only here domestically with our own LAI indicator, we follow almost 19 here domestically, 4 overseas. All of those are in positive territory. So we've got to go with the indicators, what they tell us. And then the big one is our recession indicator. It was almost near 20 prior to the election, dropped all the way down to 5. It's at 12.5 and has been rising, but it's nowhere close to any area that would indicate a significant risk. So we'll end like this. We're still dancing.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. 486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
You know, Financial Sense News Hour listeners should remember that our premium members are able to hear the weekday Financial Sense News Hour featuring interviews with top economic commentators and experts. If you're not a member, here's one of the interviews you missed this week.
There's no question that jobs are going to change, and they're going to change dramatically. There's no question that AI, artificial intelligence, will disrupt a lot of jobs. The question is whether it will create new ones. In the past, we have seen new jobs develop as a result of the increased efficiencies, the lower labor costs, and so forth, new opportunities would come to the fore. Whether that will happen this time is the question that we don't know how to answer. There are several reasons that a lot of people in the tech community, a lot of labor economists as well, are pessimistic about the future. One is what's called machine learning. It looks as if technology is now training machines to learn on their own. And this has meant an exponential advance in what artificial intelligence is capable of doing. Machine learning means that the machine itself, the computer itself, is figuring out new algorithms on its own. So it finds patterns and develops sort of theories. It does some of the things that we never thought machines could do. They virtually think and anticipate and predict and develop theories. The other reason that the tech community and labor economists are worried is because this advance, AI, will impact practically every sector. This is not just low-skilled workers who are at risk. It is some white-collar workers as well.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour, and the part of the program which we call the Big Picture, in which we try to put perspective to the things that you are seeing or hearing out there. We are awash in data points, but what you need is a higher perspective of exactly what's going on. Coming out of the last segment, you remember we were discussing the economy right now, looking pretty much as good as it gets for now. And we wanted to explore a bit more how all of this might play out in the financial markets. And I know this has been no end of conversation here, Jim, on the show. There are usually three phases to both bull and bear markets. And as we're now in the late stages of what is a business cycle, given that that's the case, then we should begin the process of topping in stock prices. And you've also talked about the different phases of the top: bonds, stocks, and then commodities.
Well, if you take a look at the last bear markets that began, we had one in 81, 91, 2001, and 2007. That has typically been the pattern. Usually you see the bond market top out first. And the reason for that is because the Fed is raising interest rates. Obviously, if the general level of interest rates are, let's just say today at 2%, and the Fed raises interest rates to 3%, what's that going to do? It's going to cause the price of bonds to fall, which means that the bond market generally tops out first. And then second, stocks at first do not top out when the Fed begins to raise interest rates, because the feeling is the economy is doing well enough and is strong enough that it allows the Fed to raise interest rates. So the markets usually assume that's a good sign of a strong economy. Eventually, however, the Fed will start raising rates, and at some point, the higher interest rates will begin to choke off economic growth through the credit mechanism. Rates will start to rise. Businesses will pull back. The economy will slow down, and then stocks peak. And then finally, in the third phase, you usually see commodities peak, because you're towards the end of the business cycle when the economy is going strong. What does that mean? More energy consumption, more consumption of base metals, and commodities are the last to peak. That's exactly the way it played out in 1981. It played out that way in 1989 and 90 when the Fed began to raise interest rates, which led us into a slight bear market in 1991 and a recession. It did not happen in 1994 when the Fed doubled the Fed funds rate from 3 to 6, one of the few times that the Federal Reserve was able to raise interest rates and not crash the airplane. But in 1999, oil prices had bottomed in 1998 at $10 a barrel. As the price of oil climbed into the year 2000 to almost $35 a barrel, the Fed was raising interest rates. Bonds peaked in 99, stocks peaked in early 2000, and commodities peaked in late 2000. Fast forward to the year 2007, bonds peaked early 2007, Stocks peaked in the fall of 2007, and commodities finally peaked in the summer of 2008. So as commodities heat up, usually inflation starts to heat up. And so, John, this has been the pattern in 1981, 1991, 2001, and 2008.
Well, I'm curious here as to how this plays out, because typically the individual investor has been absent from this bull market until just recently.
Well, in the topping process, you more often than not see a melt up of stocks. If you can think of what was going on, for example, in 1998, all the way up to 2000, where the market was going up, even though we had a crisis in 97 and 98, we had the Asian crisis in 97, the Fed flooded the markets with money. 98, Russian debt default, long-term capital management, Fed flooded the markets with money. Did so likewise in 99, at the same time they were raising interest rates. So you typically see towards the latter stages of a bull market, individual investors start to come in the market because it looks like it's easy money. The markets are going up. They're setting new records. They're going up double digits a year. I mean, think of 1995 to the beginning of the year 2000. In fact, into, let's say, the first quarter of 2000, the stock market was going up double digits each year. In fact, from January to March of the year 2000, the NASDAQ went up another 20% after being up 70% in the year before. Now, we haven't seen that in this bull market. The bull market has been mainly fueled this time by corporate buybacks, which in the last couple of years have been averaging almost $500 billion a year. It's also been fueled by central bank buying, and that has now changed since the Trump election. What you're starting to see is the individual investor is back in the stock market again after being absent for almost 9 years.
Okay, well, this is a profound switch then, because what, for the last 8 or 9 years, individual investors have been in, well, either bond funds or cash.
Well, I mean, take a look at any time in the late 90s, it was the tech bubble. The last decade, it was mainly real estate. Of course, the stock market also hit levels that it hadn't reached since March of the year 2000. It got up to that level in September of 2007. So you always look at what area is being overemphasized. What's the story? What's the big thing that investors gravitate? Whether it's, as we discussed last week around a bubble, it's centers around an idea. And the idea right now is index ETFs. It's mindless investing. And the big bubble, if you look at where we are today versus where we were a year ago, close to $360 billion is flown into index ETFs. That's not even counting the money going into index mutual funds year over year. They're estimating for this year, $800 billion will flow into index funds, up 60% over last year, in a combination of index ETFs and index mutual funds. And individuals are rushing in to open up stock accounts. John, we haven't seen this since 2000. Charles Schwab recently reported that clients have opened up a record 350,000 new stock accounts in the second quarter alone. Year to date, Schwab has opened up almost close to 720,000 new stock accounts, up 34% for the year. The biggest increase in individual stock accounts in 17 years. In other words, you would have to go back to the peak year of the bubble in 2000 to see this many investors flowing into the market. It's the strongest first half in Schwab's history. In the last 17 years, there's been nothing like it. And that's usually what you want to see in the final phase of a bull market.
You know, this is the thing that you've always said happens in the final phase of a bull market, is when finally what I call the public or the street wakes up and says, oh, wow, look at all that stuff's going. It's going. And you hear the phrase up and up and up, right? They realize that there have been fabulous gains to be made. And there is nothing worse than finding out that your neighbor's getting rich and you haven't been making use of the opportunity. The danger, of course, here, Jim, is as things roll over, they get stuck with a lot of things going down.
Yeah, and I think what's attracting everybody is this year, I think we've had 47 new records in the Dow. And this Friday, the Dow is over 22,000 at another record high. So when you turn on the evening news or you hear your neighbors or you're looking at your 401k statements and you're saying that, wow, the market is up double digits, boy, I can't lose money in this. And just as from 1998 to 2000, day trading is all the fad, and think of 2010 and 2011 is investing in gold and silver was all the fad. Well, today the big fad is index ETFs and index mutual funds. But the fact that the public is back in, to me, is a sign that we're in the beginning of the final phase. They're going into index ETFs and index mutual funds is a can't lose proposition. I mean, gosh, you're going to go up as much as the market. I mean, how can one go wrong? You're diversified in an index fund, the entire index, whether it's the Dow, the NASDAQ, or it's the S&P 500. They're even going into index international funds. So like day trading, going into index funds is a sure win, can't lose, like the day trading in 1998 and 2000. It really reminds me of a very similar situation. What they don't realize is by going into an index fund, yes, you're going to capture 100% of the market's gain. So if you're in the S&P and the S&P's up 10%, well, you're going to be up 10%. However, what they fail to realize is when the market turns in the opposite direction, just like when the market peaked, the S&P peaked in September of 2007, between September 2007 and March 9th of 2009, the S&P lost 58%. That's what they don't tell them, and who will tell them, because it seems like, you know, you don't need anybody. You can just become rich just by investing in the market. And this is the one thing that's usually comes in the final phase, because up until really the Trump election, the individual investor has been absent the market, mainly in bond funds, as reflected in the inflow, because we track inflows into ETFs and mutual funds, but that has changed since the presidential election.
I would think this would raise some concerns or flags when everybody is running into the same thing, because there's the old yelling fire in a crowded movie theater and the same crowd of people that have gone in now all want to get out.
Well, what concerns me is the vast majority of dollars are going into these ETFs, and that is where the bubble is forming. And that is what is driving up these market valuations of some of these FANG stocks, as we have covered a number of months ago on this show when we first did a story on the bubble that was forming. Because, you know, as we looked at who would buy in their right mind and pay 260 times earnings for Amazon? Well, a fund manager or anybody doing any kind of analysis would not do that. But if you're in an index fund, you don't ask those questions. If you're an S&P index fund, 3% of every dollar you raise goes into Amazon and goes into these big market cap stocks. So today, when I look at the stock market, whether it's the Dow or the S&P, the thing that's rather interesting is if you take a look at who owns them, they're all index funds. And the other thing is when you look at individual stocks, you look at some of the largest holding stocks in the Dow Industrials, whether it's Apple, whether it's Amazon, Google, Alphabet, Netflix, who are the largest owners? The top 10 owners of those stocks, and most of the stocks I look at, the top 10 owners are index funds. So when the public and institutions all wake up to the point that we're in a bear market and they want to sell, most of these ETFs and index funds are held by the five largest mutual fund families. Not only do they have index mutual funds, but they are also the sponsor of index ETFs. So let's just picture the top 10 funds own the vast majority of stocks that are out there. You got 10 guys in a room. They're all looking at each other and they decide we want to get out. Who are they going to sell to? If you're Fidelity or if you're Vanguard and your investors start pulling out money, is Vanguard going to sell to Fidelity? Is Fidelity going to sell to Vanguard? No way. So the question is, and I think this is something that the regulators haven't really focused on, what happens when we enter the final phase of the market And all of a sudden, individual investors find out, oh my God, I'm down 15, 20% in my index fund. And then all of a sudden, you know, somebody yells fire in the movie theater and everybody crowds and tries to get out at once. As Greg Weldon talked about in hour one, you have the makings of a flash crash.
Right. So let's stipulate, Jim, that you're right, that we're entering the final phase here now. I'm sure there are little sub-phases that go on during this time. And what will those signposts be?
Well, I mean, we have a good indication. We know we're in a Fed rate raising cycle, and the Fed has indicated in its latest meeting that they want to begin shrinking their balance sheet this fall. So we could see that begin in October. The ECB, which is one of the reasons you've seen a backup in German bond yields and yields in Europe, have indicated maybe it's time that they end their bond buying program and they start taper. So Europe's economy is doing well along with the US. So no longer do central banks feel they need to keep interest rates lower. So you are going to see a rate raising cycle. The US is ahead of everybody, which is one reason, as Ari Wald talked about in hour one, one of the reasons that's kept a damper on long-term interest rates here is there is a huge gulf or spread between corporate bonds and sovereign bonds, let's say U.S. Treasuries in the United States compared to Europe. But the thing that you have to understand is we are starting at a much lower level and we can rise for a while longer without any damage to the economy. Because when the Fed started raising interest rates in 2004, the Fed funds rate was 1%. We're only at 1.25% today. I just don't think the Fed or the European Central Bank is going to get to interest rate levels that we were before. In other words, get the Fed funds rate in the 5-6% level because, John, there is a lot more debt in the system today. In the year 2000, the U.S. government only had $5 trillion in debt. Bush doubled it to $10 trillion. Obama doubled that to $20 trillion. And we're still adding debt, and that debt is growing. But unlike Obama's first 8 years in office, this time the Treasury is paying a higher interest rate because for 8 years, interest rates fell on U.S. debt. Every single year, the government paid less and less for its interest expense, even though the debt was climbing. So with the U.S. global economy still growing, and the one thing that we have right now is we have synchronized global growth. The U.S. economy is growing. Picked up in the second quarter, as we talked in the first segment. Europe's economy is growing. Japan's economy is growing. China's economy is still growing. So we have synchronized economic growth, which continue. The other aspect that bodes well for the market in the near term is corporate profits. And unlike before, revenues are accelerating. And this could accelerate even more if we come back from, let's say, the summer recess, but I don't know if they're going to be able to get tax reform because when they come back after Labor Day, they have 12 days of legislation, and at the top of the agenda is the debt ceiling, which expires at the government's fiscal year, September 30th. So the most important thing, and they're haggling, Democrats refuse to budge, Republicans refuse to budge, so the first thing they're going to have to work on is the debt ceiling debate, so forget tax reform. They have to get through this one first. But right now, selling prices are outpacing the rise in wages, so profit margins are expanding for most companies. Earnings are also growing in Europe, where the economy is still expanding. And on top of that, the emerging markets are doing well, but I expect that we will see problems in China reemerge. And again, that will impact emerging markets. But eventually, look for weakening to occur both in Europe and Asia as central banks there begin to either taper or raise interest rates, just as the Fed has begun to do that here starting back in 2014.
Well, in the U.S., corporations have leveraged up. But you know that both rising wages and also interest rates, sooner or later, that's got to cut into corporate profits, and that directly affects the economy.
It's not just that, John. The thing that we really don't understand right now, there is so much debt in the system with corporations and with individuals. We're already seeing it, as we talked in the last segment. The major banks from Citigroup to JP Morgan are reporting problems with credit card defaults are increasing. They're up over 3%. So already starting to see signs of trouble with individual investors. We haven't seen it with corporations yet. But on top of that, valuations in the market are stretched relative to history of the stock market. Now, of course, if they cut tax rates, that could change, because if you cut tax rates from 35 to 20, companies will make 60% more money, which could lower those valuations. You make the same amount of profit, but you keep more of it, which translates to higher earnings on the bottom line. So what we're looking for now as we get into the fourth quarter, as I spoke with Greg Weldon in hour one, we're watching oil prices and inflation, because oil is close to $50 and it could be in the high 50s by the end of the year, although we expect some softness in oil prices as we head into the shoulder months, because in 30 days we'll be heading into the fall. The summer driving season will be over. The weather will be nicer, so we'll be consuming less energy. So it'll be interesting to see what happens to inventory levels, because nobody's really paying attention to that. Inventory levels keep dropping in the U.S. So the other thing, too, on the inflation front, the U.S. dollar has dropped from 102. It's down to 91. That is helping to lift import prices. So as growth picks up here, as it did in the second quarter, and abroad, you should start to see inflation rise, and the impact is going to be eventually lower profit margins. And as inflation rises, that will only give more impetus for the Fed to get more aggressive in raising rates, which is typically what they do as inflation picks up.
Well, I think at this stage, though, the markets have been actually expecting the Fed to be gradual in the way they raise rates. And I would assume that would allow the markets to adapt if the Fed goes slowly, because if you look at averaging out the number of times they've done it, 4 times in 4 years is what we're looking at.
Well, you got to remember what the Fed says can always change. You know, what do we hear so many times coming from the Fed? They're data dependent. And right now, inflation has been trending lower. So the Fed has been somewhat moderate in what they're saying in terms of they're raising interest rates. But what happens if interest rates start to rise? Let's say oil prices get into the 50s again. We start seeing inflation heat up closer towards their target of 2%. I mean, John, they can always change this. They could have a meeting, although I think these guys have got to be leery about shocking the market. And that's what they've gone out of their way to basically say, look, we want you to know what we're going to do, because they've done that with the shrinking of the balance sheet, because they didn't want to go through the taper tantrum that was sprung on the market in May of 2014 that led to almost a doubling of 10-year treasuries. That's the last thing they want to do right now. So the markets expect a gradual Fed rate hike, shrinking the balance sheet beginning in the fall, and then a rate hike maybe the end of the year. But John, if inflation starts to heat up, watch for the Fed to change its language, just as it did in December of last year when they had their meeting. They raised interest rates and they said, oh, by the way, for 2017, we've changed our mind. Instead of 2 rate hikes, we are going to raise interest rates 3 times. And they raised them in January. They raised them in March. So they've already raised interest rates twice. So like all cycles in history, history will repeat itself, maybe not the same way. It may be some other event, but eventually as inflation begins to rise, and this is something I think as an investor, you have to look at this inflation trade as we head into Q4 of this year.
So now the fatal question I always ask, what should investors be doing and or watching?
Do what we're doing. We're watching the LEIs. We're watching our recession indicator. And as Ray Dalio said, if you're dancing on the floor, make sure you're pretty close to the exit door and dance close to it. So you better have an exit strategy.
Okay, so I'm assuming then that you're going to have an exit strategy. And the question would be what?
Well, I mean, the two things that we watch are our proprietary LEIs. We have 19 that we follow, and we went over most of them in segment one. We also watch our recession indicator, which has risen to 12.5. That's up from 5. Right now, depending on accounts, we're 70 to 80%, but we're shifting tactically. We've got a greater weight international because the international markets have broken out of, as you heard Ari Wald talk about, a breakout of a 10-year downtrend. And we're shifting tactically. But, you know, at some point when you see these LEIs roll over, when you see the recession indicator hit close to 2020, when you see divergences in between the major indexes, a breakup where usually towards the latter stages of a bull market, it's the generals that lead the markets higher, but more and more individual stocks begin to fall off and go into their bear market. So as we see that tactically, we will be making shifts in our account because, I mean, they don't ring a bell at the top. It's a process. And it's not like you play one more hand at the roulette wheel and then you walk away. That's not the way it works, because that last hand you play could be the last hand that wipes you out. And so you gradually, tactically begin to exit and reduce your holdings, because if anything comes out of the blue, a black swan event, a bankruptcy or something that triggers and begins the acceleration. I mean, think back at 2007, it began with the bankruptcy of Bear Stearns and two of their major funds that they had. They were invested in mortgage-backed securities, and then it was just a series of blow after blow after blow. The market peaked in September of 2007, commodity prices and inflation rose, and then until you got to the summer of 2008 when we hit $150 on a barrel of oil. By then, the Fed didn't even realize it. The markets didn't realize it, but the recession began officially in December of 2007. We didn't talk about a recession until the fall of 2001, nearly 1 year after it began. So that's why tactically you have to have an exit plan and you have to be investing differently today. I certainly wouldn't be in chasing index funds. I certainly wouldn't be chasing the FANG stocks unless you are very astute and disciplined as a trader. But right now, you can still dance. But like I say, move your partner closer to the exit door.
Well, it's going to be interesting in the weeks and months to come to see how this thing plays out according to the scenario we've been talking about. And in the weeks and months to come, what are we looking forward to?
Well, in the month of August, traders are in the Hamptons, so don't expect much low-volume days. We have Jackson Hole coming up in the month of August. They'll be looking to Janet Yellen to signal, is the Fed getting ready to proceed with their shrinking their balance sheet? But I think the big event in September is going to be Congress has 12 days to come together with a compromise on the debt ceiling debate. So that will be the big thing in September. I don't expect the Fed to do anything other than maybe to announce that they're going to begin shrinking their balance sheet, which could come as early as October. It'll be interesting to see how the markets handle that. They keep telling us they want to resurrect healthcare and they also want to get tax reform. But my goodness, they got 12 days to get together the budget ceiling debate. Otherwise, technically, the U.S. goes into default. It's a bigger story. Technically, they don't default, but the media will play this out and scare the bejesus out of investors. So you could see a little pullback in the market if that happens. But that's the big thing coming back after Labor Day is the debt ceiling debate. So that, and then also towards the end of September, you will get Q3 earnings. So far, earnings have been the strong point, which has been driving this market higher. But we'll be here to talk about it. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.